locked room. I'm Mardell. And this week's story is The Affair of the Stokehole by Edgar Wallace. Larry Lohman of the Criminal Intelligence Department was called to a conference at headquarters and went with a certain sense of disappointment and irritation, though there was no reason for a display of either of those emotions, for both his chief and the Secretary of State, responsible for his department, had nothing but encouragement for him. "You are not going to smash the crime trust in a day," said the Chief Commissioner for Special Services. "I suppose there is no doubt about there being a crime trust?" asked the minister dubiously. "It seems such an extremely melodramatic idea, the sort of thing one reads in sensational stories." "It is a very good idea from the criminal's point of view," said the commissioner quietly. "He has no worry. He is well supported, whether he is in prison or out. He is always excellently defended, and if he is convicted, his unknown employers will take his case to the Court of Criminal Appeal. If there is the slightest chance of a sentence being reduced or a trial being quashed, the man who brought together all these expert criminals, and the trust has no use for any other, was a genius. Could anything be neater than to run a forging plant in a nursing home where all the rooms except two or three were occupied by genuine patients, and all the staff except the principal and a few of his friends were genuine nurses and doctors? How are things shaping, Larry?" Larry Lohman, his elbows on the table, his face between his hands, shook his head. "We have settled the forgeries," he said a little hopelessly. "But the other departments of the trust are in full swing, and very successfully so." "For example," said the chief commissioner, "the kidnapping and holding to ransom of Lord Furthermore's heir." "I wanted to see you about that," said the minister. "Do you think it is the work of the trust?" "I'm certain of it," said Larry emphatically. "Look at the price they are asking. £60,000. Nobody but the trust would dare do it. Nobody but the trust has the organization which would enable them to carry out a scheme of that importance." "There is terrible trouble about the kidnapping," said the minister. "I have brought you here to take you off the trust and put you on to that." Larry laughed. "You can safely retain me on the trust work," he said dryly. "All the bad crimes that will be committed in this country during the next 12 months will bear the indelible hallmark of that organization." "You know the circumstances of the kidnapping?" asked the commissioner. Larry nodded. "The boy was out with his nurse in Regent's Park. The nurse found herself in conversation with a lady who suddenly turned faint and had to be assisted to one of the garden chairs. When the nurse looked around, the child had gone, and a motor car was seen driving off in the adjoining roadway. No number of the car seems to have been taken. By the time the nurse had found a policeman, the fainting lady had also disappeared." "Lord Furthermore is distracted," said the minister. "He has seen me twice this morning. He had a letter from the gang. Here it is." He passed the epistle across the table. It was typewritten on thick notepaper and ran, "I am holding your son to ransom and am demanding 300,000 francs for his release. The money must be paid in 1,000-franc notes and delivered to a messenger who will be a perfectly innocent agent in the matter. The method of the boy's restoration will be sent to you if you advertise your agreement in the Times. The Knight of Industry." "The Trust," said Larry confidently. "They have used that signature before. From what I have heard, the gentleman who is at the head of the business attends his board meetings in complete armor with lowered visor." "Theatrical nonsense," growled the minister. "It is neither theatrical nor nonsensical," said Larry calmly. "In the first place, he is protected against a chance pistol shot from a traitor or a hidden policeman. And he is so completely disguised that neither his face nor his figure is observable. I will take this letter, if I may." He folded it up and put it in his pocket. "I have an appointment with my specialist." "How is the memory trouble?" Larry made a grimace. "I haven't had a recurrence for over a week." "Who is your doctor?" asked the minister. "Grayborn, clever fellow. A man who has won the first place in his profession by sheer industry. 10 years ago, a struggling practitioner up to his eyes in debt through an extravagant wife. Today, I suppose, he is making more money than any other man in his profession. The fees he charges me are prodigious, prodigious." "You're not making Larry very happy," smiled the commissioner, but Larry was incapable of further depression that morning. He was ushered into the consulting room, and the specialist, without delay, went through the formal examination, which Sir George Grayborn always gave to his patients. "I think you're all right," said the doctor. "You have had no further sudden lapses of memory?" "None," said Larry. "Avoid excitement. I know it's a foolish thing to ask you, but remember that any undue excitement will produce that extraordinary lapse and blot out hours of memory from your life. Amnesia is a queer disease." "Don't I know it?" said Larry ruefully. "It is a nightmare to me every time I realize that all the things that happened to me after 4 may be completely forgotten until I recover my memory at 8. I live in dread of that little buzz in the ear, which tells me that memory is ringing off." "Where are you going this afternoon?" asked the physician suddenly. "Nowhere in particular," said Larry after a moment's thought. "A little social recreation would not do you any harm," said Sir George. "I am going to a garden party at Regent Gardens. It is on behalf of the Home for Factory Girls. Will you join me there?" Larry had made no plans for that afternoon. And it was a rule of his life that when he had no plans, he was prepared to be guided by any fortuitous development that day might bring forth. "I will join you," he said. "The ticket will cost you a guinea, and I will put it on my bill, which, by the way, will not be heavy," he said, looking over his shoulder as he unlocked a little cupboard behind his desk. "You are a thought reader, among other things, Sir George." The physician did not reply. He handed the gilt-edged pasteboard to his patient. "I will meet you at 4:30, he said, "near the bandstand." Dressing for the function, Larry came to the conclusion that he might have done worse than accept the invitation. If one of his extraordinary memory lapses came on, he would have the advantage of his doctor's society and the observation which Sir George might make, and, what was no less important, the data he might supply as to what Larry did while in the dubious enjoyment of his periodical fits of oblivion. He took out the revolver and replaced it with a little Browning, with no great improvement. He put the Browning on the table. It was against his best instincts to go out without some kind of weapon, and he pulled open drawer after drawer, and finally selected a short and, what was more to the purpose, flat hunting knife in its sheath. In a rough and tumble, it might be more useful even than firearms. He drove to the gardens and found, as he approached the entrance, such a block of taxicabs and private motor cars that he descended and walked the rest of the distance on foot. He crushed through the turnstiles and was immediately pounced upon by a bevy of beautiful brigands with tickets for sideshows and badges and flags and refreshment vouchers. He parted meekly with his money, and as soon as he could make his way free of the crowd, he wandered to the part of the garden which he knew would be unfrequented. It was a glorious summer day. The hot June sun was tempered by a cooling breeze, and in the bosky sidewalks with their high hedges of flowering shrubs. He found a certain restfulness and comfort. He passed a small telephone box, placed there as an inscription informed him for the convenience of visitors, and he marveled at the foresight and intelligence which had induced the organizers to place this very necessary connecting link with the outside world in so quiet and retiring a spot. It would be useful when he wanted to call his car. He strolled on slowly, for he knew the path would soon turn him back to the crush. And then suddenly he saw a girl ahead of him. She was dressed in white, and her back was turned toward him. She was evidently selling something, for she had a little tray before her. He debated the question as to whether he would return, but curiosity got the better of him. Here evidently was a kindred soul who also wished to get free from the madding throng. He was walking past her when she spoke. "Won't you buy a little rose?" said a sweet voice. He turned round and looked her in the face, and something buzzed in his ears and memory stopped. He knew his memory was returning, yet the sensation was as though he was beginning life at its very commencement, and that all existence must date from this moment. He felt a strong wind in his face, and he knew his hands were grasping something rough and hard. Then he realized he was sitting on a stone ledge. He looked down, and strong as were his nerves, he nearly swooned. Then he looked back into the black, yawning chasm behind him. How had he got here? In the name of heaven, how had he got here? He was sitting on the top of a high chimney stack, 150 feet above the level of the ground. He was dressed in his shirt and his trousers. He wore neither collar nor coat. His varnished boots were split and scratched. His white spats were black. He looked at his hand. It was covered with soot, and he gathered that his face was in no better state. He had recovered something of his presence of mind and something of the coolness which he knew he had displayed through all this lapse of hours, even though the sudden consciousness of his position had temporarily shaken his confidence and nerve. He crawled back to the black funnel of the stack and looked down. He had evidently come up that way, for inside the stack, as far as I could see down, were iron rungs firmly fixed in the masonry. At the worst, he could go down that way again, he thought. But even as this method of escape occurred to him, a thick cloud of smoke billowed up from the depths. He crept round to the other side of the parapet, and what he found brought comfort. Apparently the chimney had at some period been under repair, and there was a scaffolding here and a ladder which ran at an alarming angle to join a further ladder which, so far as he could see, by lying flat on his face and looking over the edge, continued to the foot of the stack. He shuddered at the thought of making the descent by this method, but bracing himself up, he swung his legs over the platform, felt for the rungs of the ladder, and began his descent. He was halfway down before it occurred to him that some of the sections of the ladder might not be in place. It evidently had been up for a considerable time, and one rung he touched was so rotten that his foot crashed through it. 50 feet from the ground, he did indeed find that a short length had either fallen or been pulled from its place. But by letting himself slowly down till his feet touched the top of the next section, he was able, by grasping the staples which still remained in the brickwork, to make the rest of the descent in safety. It was not until he had reached the ground that he realized that all the time he had been carrying the knife in his hand. He carefully examined the blade, but it afforded him no clue. Possibly a careful search of the buildings would assist him. He was evidently in the yard of a disused factory. Rusty old railway lines overgrown by weeds, discarded machine parts in the same condition, and a general air of desolation pervaded the yard, which was enclosed by a high brick wall. He looked up at the chimney, which was now sending out thick smoke. "Somebody must be here," he thought, and he moved cautiously. If only he could remember what had happened in the last few hours. He heard the whir of a motor car, and crouching down behind a slag heap, he saw a car carrying three people pass along the factory roadway and disappear behind some low buildings, which he judged were somewhere near the gate. In this supposition he was right, for a little while later he heard the clang of the gate as it closed. He waited for 5 minutes, but there was no further sign of life. The smoke was thinning and was now but a white, tenuous mist that floated from the top of the chimney. He had already identified the building by a heap of discarded tins bearing the label of the Boscombe Enamel Company, a derelict firm that had been out of business for many years. There were a number of sheds, all deserted, some of them padlocked and some windowless. He reached what was evidently the engine house without being challenged. The smoke must come from the stokehole, and to the stokehole he made his way. The fire doors were hot, and the big furnace was still filled with a red glowing mass. He picked up an iron rake and poked about the inside, and presently pulled out a small metal bracket of a familiar shape. In its pristine days it had been part of a telephone transmitter. He raked again and drew up pieces of red-hot wire and the metal part of a telephone receiver, and shook his head. They meant nothing to him. Leading from the stokehole was a steel door, which he pushed, and which yielded under his touch. He found himself in a small room with walls of whitewashed brick. It had been newly swept, and there was a table and chair, which were free from dust. "Somebody has been here in the last half hour," said Larry to himself, and stepped stealthily forward to the next door. He listened, for he thought he heard voices. He gently pressed the door, and it opened. Somebody was speaking within.
"I'll bet you'll be glad to see his nibs again, won't you?"
The reply was so faint that Larry could not hear it.
"Well," said the voice, "if you're a good boy, they'll let you go tomorrow. And if you ever see me in the street, don't you recognize me, dear? Because if you do, I'll cut your throat. Do you see what I mean?"
Larry balanced his knife in his hand and pushed the door open and walked into the room. A man in his shirt sleeves was confronting a small and tearful boy who sat upon what was evidently his bed. Larry's heart gave a thump, for he recognized in the child the heir of the Feathermoors. The man did not hear Larry's entrance, but something in the boy's frightened look, for Larry in his coating of soot was a terrifying sight, made the man spin round. As he did, the detective closed in on him and dropped the point of his knife against the lower button of the guard's waistcoat.
"Hands up," said Larry, "and quick."
The man's hands went up. He shot a sidelong glance at a table, and following his eyes, Larry saw the revolver and sprang for it.
"I think you know me," said the young man. "I am Mr. Lohman of the Criminal Intelligence Department, and I am going to take you into custody on a charge of kidnapping."
"It's a cop," said the man. "Don't be so certain you're going to get a conviction, old friend."
"Not so much of the old friend," said Larry. "I have seen your prisoner," said the commissioner the next morning, "and he has undergone, at the hands of two experienced police officers, something approaching the immoral and reprehensible third degree of the USA, which we so often condemn, but which is not without its uses. Would you like me to reconstruct your remarkable story?"
"I wish you would, sir," said Larry earnestly. "I've been puzzling my brains over the matter, and I cannot for the life of me recall one single instant between 4:30 in the afternoon and 8:00 that same night."
"Then stand by for a little wholesome reconstruction," said the commissioner. "I thought it would be an easy matter, because I had taken the precaution of having you shadowed by one of the best men at Scotland Yard, but he was unable to tell me a great deal. And I have the most important part of the story from the fellow you took in the works. You were seen to go into the shrubbery at 5:25, and you were followed at a respectful distance by the officer. You were seen to speak to a lady selling flowers, to pass your hand across your forehead as though you were a little stunned, and then something seemed to occur to you. Probably you recognized the girl, and you came striding back the way you had come and met Sergeant Jackson, whom you dispatched with orders to find Sir George Greyborn at the bandstand. Evidently you were aware that the phase of forgetfulness was closing in upon you. You then turned back, and the sergeant, over his shoulder, saw you go into the telephone box. Why you went there is conjectural. I suggest that you intended to telephone for your car." Larry nodded. He remembered that he had had that intention. "The rest of the story is told by our prisoner as far as he witnessed it, or was able to learn the particulars from those who participated. You had no sooner entered the telephone box than two men sprang from the shrubbery and slammed the door, shutting you in. You will probably remember, if you saw it in the course of your wanderings, that it was without windows and that the interior was specially padded to make it soundproof." "I noticed that," said Larry, "as I passed the box the first time. The moment the door closed on you, you were helpless. The other men who were waiting in the shrubbery came out, lifted the box on their shoulders, and you were passed out of the gate, placed on a waiting motor lorry, and driven off. It was a very neat trick, and possibly, even if you had not gone in of your own accord, you would have been lured to that part of the garden and induced to enter the box. I suggest that, finding yourself stifling, you remembered your knife, and cut through the padding and the thin wood, and, having secured air vents, you awaited developments. You were taken to the old factory, my young friend, and this is where our kidnapping prisoner offers first-hand testimony. At 6:15 in the afternoon, the lorry came in, and the box was carried into the stokehole, which was already filled with an assortment of shavings, wood, and coal, and you and your box were thrust in. You must have realized your awful predicament and set to work desperately to cut your way out. To escape through the steel door of the furnace was impossible, and I suggest that you squeezed your way along the little tunnel which leads to the chimney shaft, and that minus your coat and hat and all unnecessary impedimenta, you climbed the interior of the stack, and would probably have made a good descent, in fact, the same descent that you did make, or even had you not recovered consciousness of the immediate past. I have had the works raided, and there is no doubt that this place has been hired and fitted up with the object of carrying out an extensive scheme of kidnapping. Furthermore's child says that he had been there and treated kindly since the day he was whisked off." "The whole theory fits together," said Larry, "and I have no doubt that you are right." "I am certain I am right," said the commissioner quietly. "I myself have been in the stokehole and have rescued." He rose and went to a cupboard, opened it, and took out a battered and shapeless object. "Your stovepipe hat, Larry." Larry looked at the relic and laughed. "Also, there were the marks of your toes against the soot in the interior of the stack, bits of the lock of the telephone box, and several other et cetera's." Larry was thinking hard. "The girl who sold roses," he said suddenly, "it was she." "What?" demanded the commissioner. "Something about her face, something that reminded me of—" The commissioner nodded. "Yes, she was in it," he said quietly. "Our prisoner said she came back to the factory and went on her knees to the rascal in charge of the cremation and begged him to spare you." "I think, when I meet her," said Larry, "and I know I have met her, the crime trust will be very nearly on its last legs." Join me next week for another case of murder and mystery on The Locked Room. And in the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark.
Thank you.